Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to the Simplicity Zen podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you could take a moment and hit like, subscribe if you haven't done so, and you could always comment on the video. That helps motivate YouTube's algorithm to share this podcast to new people. If you're watching on one of the audio apps, such as Stitcher or whatever, you can subscribe through that app. You can also go to the website, simplicityzen.com, and sign up for the mailing list there. I love hearing from people. So if you want to reach out, my email address is in the link at the top of the page. So today, my guest is Rinzai Zen priest, Sozui Schubert. She's the teacher at Hidden Valley Zen Center in San Marcos, California. She was ordained by legendary Zen master Shoto Harada Roshi and studied with him for decades at Sogenji, his monastery in Okayama, Japan. At the instructions of her teacher, she has helped establish practice communities in Hungary, Germany, Latvia, Italy, and Russia, and of course, there in Hidden Valley, which I believe is near, that's in between Los Angeles and San Diego, if I understand correctly, right?
A little closer to San Diego. And this has been here since over 50 years. So it started long before me.
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, formally you're the assistant teacher, but practically you're kind of the full-time teacher there. Is that correct?
Mitra Roshi stepped down just at the beginning of COVID officially. So if we want to be technical, then the board would have to promote me to senior teacher because technically I'm still assistant spiritual director, but you know, it's only me here. So
Do you guys have a full-time residence at this point, aside from yourself?
Right now we don't. In summer we had a couple of people, so that fluctuates.
And
it's laid out like a monastery for full monastic practice. We have a whole residential building, almost too comfortable, with at least room for at least 10 people.
So are most of the people who come by, are they part of the, do they live kind of within driving distance, or are people flying in, you know, what is kind of the sangha?
Both. I mean, including occasionally somebody will fly in from Europe. You know, people that I've met there before a long time ago, but mostly it's locals and then people that are within the One Drop system somehow.
And so do you have people come down from Washington, the Tohono Monastery and stuff like that?
People who have trained there and now live in, let's say, San Francisco, and they can get a good ticket coming down here. And it's also people's needs. So the traditional erring on the harsh edge of training is not necessarily right for everybody. And I've noticed that many people benefit from being reminded to not push so much, be kind to ourselves, be a little bit more integrated in that way, because a lot of the traditional Zen culture seems to encourage our negative thinking about ourselves. We all have nasty inner critics already, and then you have a Japanese culture on top of that that never praises traditionally, only criticizes. And it's good to let go of the ego, but we see so many people with depression and anxiety going on these days. So a little bit more subtle approach can sometimes be very helpful and help prevent people from stagnating in their practice.
Have you seen the documentary Carving the Divine?
Not the whole thing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Seen the ads and the introductions and pieces of it.
Yeah, I interviewed the filmmaker, and he sent me the link to watch it afterwards as you know, which I appreciated. And I was really shocked by the video in a lot of ways, because, you know, I've sat in some fairly traditional Zen places, you know, as a guest, you know, during session and stuff. And so I got to experience a little bit of the kind of the harsh, you know, you're not given in any instructions, you only learn the rule when you break it type of, or by watching people type of, but I was really kind of unprepared for, you know, the apprenticeship style in that movie. And so basically it's all these, you know, people who are carving these Buddha statues being apprenticed to this master. And, you know, the amount of the way he treats them by Western standards would be abuse, like never any compliments. You know, the closest thing they'll get to a compliment is like, well, this doesn't suck, you know. And, I mean, it's crazy. And then plus there's, you know, the book, you know, Eat, Sleep, Sit, you know, about the guy's memoirs, a time at AHG and all the, you know, the abuse he gets there. And it really hits home, you know, how that, you know, traditional Japanese apprenticeship is really kind of intense.
It is wonderful for the right person at the right time.
Yeah.
It works, right? But you got to have a clear sense of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You need a minimum of psychological health. Mm-hmm. And I do physical health.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's been good for me when I've encountered it, because I really don't like being told what to do. Like, that's kind of one of my button-pushing things. And it's really good for me to be in a situation where I'm basically a baby or you know, and I have like no self-autonomy at all. And I'm just completely told what to do. It's been really good. You know, it's been good from a practice perspective when I'm in those situations, you know.
That's what I love. I mean, when I got to Japan, I had read, you know, some martial arts books, some Miyamoto Musashi. I've heard about the harsh treatment and was kind of into this Zen hero kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I've seen people struggle with being told what to do, but I was in heaven because I didn't need to think. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about anything. You're just being told what to do. And you just do it. And I found that extremely freeing, and I could really focus on the practice. But for most Western minds, it's a little bit challenging.
Yeah. Yes. And even when I was, you know, I did a much shorter stint of residential training compared to a lot of you guys. So I only did a year in a monastery, but I've done lots of sessions over the years. So there's kind of a similar thing there. The hardest thing for me was not having control over my schedule, you know, was like basically, you know, you get an hour or two of free time a day, you know, and it was, that was hard for me. It's hard for me to explain how it's helpful, but it just illuminates the contours of the self, you know.
Very clearly. So, yeah. 1 or 2 hours is still quite a lot. In the olden days at Sogenji, we used to have much less. Mm-hmm. But it really challenges your ego, and it makes pretty clear how suffering comes into being. Mm-hmm. So for example, you get there, and one of the things you end up doing very often is wiping the roka, wiping the wooden porches, and you mm-hmm. wipe them no matter what the temperature, and it's freezing. Mm-hmm. And the water is cold, and you are tired. You're tired and cold and maybe hungry, and you really don't want to do it. And it's going to take 20, 30 minutes, depending on how fast you run on all fours. And you don't want to do it. Now, you can entertain the thought of, I really don't want to do it. Oh, this sucks. Oh, I wish I would already be done. I really don't want to do it. And then you start cutting corners and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being suffering. And I was lucky enough to have trained some. I did a couple of sessions with 40-minute periods in Germany. So I knew I could get through it somehow, even though it would be painful. And I just realized the moment I dive in, I allow myself the whole experience, it changes. And that's just amazing how once you dive in, things open up in unexpected ways because you're not in your head anymore. Mm-hmm. And things that ego things are hard can become joyful. Just because of that. And it's a totally different experience. And so I think once you find that out, I trained myself to do that more and more. Okay, there's a resistance. Okay, dive in. Any resistance is kind of the cue to, okay, dive into the moment, open up, right? Let the energy flow. And that helped a lot.
So how did you get into Zen? So you grew up in Germany, correct?
Yeah, I grew up in Germany, and a lot of those things, I think one can only tell in retrospect. So where I am at now, at 57, is I think that I first had doubts because my parents were fighting a lot, and obviously about stupid things. They could start a fight about which case of strawberries to buy. And so I think from that, I had an early doubt about what is truth, because there must be something that you can't fight about. It's the same strawberries, right? And so that question really, really drove me for quite a while. I don't remember exactly how old I was, maybe 7, 8, 9, something like that. And I kept coming back to that question. What is truth? What is reality? Is there something absolute there? And I think over time, it must have ripened to a point where suddenly it dropped. And I remember that after that, I was able to not be divided. As a kid, go back to playing completely without, you know, having these thoughts in the background going on at the same time. What is truth? What's going on here, right? And in retrospect, I think there was a pretty significant shift that allowed me then for years to, again, be more present, maybe very much in the Zen, in the way we talk about in Zen. And then the question came back later as a late teenager going to university and looking at the state of the world then and trying to figure out what to do with my life.
Had you, as a teenager, did you have any encounters with Eastern spirituality, either through martial arts? I think you mentioned martial arts, either martial arts or yoga or Qigong or anything like that?
I looked. So the earlier teenage years, I tried out a lot of things. I tried yoga. I actually was leading a church group at some point with a friend, children's group, and found that that was all very nice and very ethical and very, you know, people were trying to be clear, but it didn't go deep enough for me. It was, you know, too much on the surface. And I didn't do martial arts personally, formally, but I did a lot of yoga. I just tried out a lot of things. And I also, then at university, I looked into politics. I looked into maybe going to Africa, trying to do something good there. If you recall, it was the time of the Cold War. There were this, I think, 71, 72 Olympic attacks that were big and kind of really touching everybody over there. And then, you know, the whole Cold War issue being in Europe, reading that in America, some travel agents advertise, go to Europe as long as it exists, that was pretty intense to deal with. And so I was active in the peace movement for quite a while, to the point where also there I realized peace movement is not necessarily peaceful. There are a lot of people that are internally not peaceful. And of course, there were encounters with the police occasionally of some more aggressive people. And anyways, I think in the bigger picture, I came to the conclusion that we cannot solve humanity's problems by external means. Even the best possible do-gooder approach, you can only do so much. We have just one body, right? And this is something I could not possibly have said at the time, right? I can only say that in retrospect. I was just searching. I was just trying this way, exploring here, exploring there. And unconsciously, I think at some point I realized there's only one way to do this effectively, and that is start here and then help other people start there. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. Otherwise, the greatest ideas will always collide in how are we going to accomplish this? We may have the same goal, and people will always fight. And so I think that made me go more distinctly into the spiritual direction.
Did you articulate it as yourself as spiritual, or do you see it more as like psychological growth? I mean, did you see it as explicitly spiritual?
Well, again, at the time, there was no such awareness. Mm-hmm. Now, looking back, I think it was probably both. Mm-hmm.
What? How did you learn about Buddhism? Like, was it through books, or did you meet somebody? Or
I think it was mostly books. I, like all teenagers, I think I had this time, at least our generation, where you hang out with friends late at night and talk about all kinds of philosophical ideas. And I did read. So I read Siddhartha, I read, Hermann Hesse, and I read Theravadan stuff, I read Tibetan stuff. But there was nothing that really clicked. And then at some point, I came across The Three Pillars of Zen by Kaplow. I think that was the same thing with you.
Absolutely.
I was not that attracted by the Enlightenment stories because I felt they were kind of blurry, but I knew there was something I wanted to find out. And here was a way to, there was a way to get there. And no other religion offered anything that clear. I mean, in my opinion, now in Christianity, there probably was a path at some point. And it's just not been transmitted.
You mentioned you were part of a church group earlier. Were you at any point, were you a Christian believer, where you believed that Christ was a deity? And
I don't think so.
Yeah. It was more cultural. Yeah. And so after you encountered Three Pillars of Zen, did you start sitting on your own, or did you seek out a group? Where in Germany did you live?
I lived in Munich at the time, so there would have been probably already some Zen groups. I studied architecture, so I was interested also in Japanese culture, and I could see the beauty of it, right? And the something deeper that shines through there that has something to do with the state of mind behind it all. And I think we kind of sense that. And I started sitting with a book until I could sit for 20, 25 minutes. And I just did 5 minutes, half lotus, which was excruciating at the time. And I worked my way up. And then I said, 5 minutes, half lotus, and then 20 minutes, even on a chair, just working with the breath, until I was at a point where I felt I was ready to look for a group. And I didn't really look. I had a memory. I remember that I was in one of those Japanese stores and somebody was hugging somebody, asking them, "Are you coming to Zazen?" So I tried to figure out where that store was, and that store still existed. And that's how I found my first Zen group.
This is in Munich?
This is in Munich, yes.
What do you remember what lineage it was in?
Well, it was a guy who had a Japanese wife. And I understand that he was, I think he may have been ordained by Hosemi Gensho Roshi, so technically Myoshinji. Mm-hmm. But he had no training. He was basically doing the cultural performance, and having a Japanese wife helped. But there was a group and they were sitting and I was fine with it. I knew that he was not going to be my teacher, right? But I could do sessions. At the time, there wasn't anything wrong going on there. And so I went as far as I could at the time. And then later, kind of around the time when I finished university, I also felt I really needed a teacher now.
Like, so how long did you sit with that group? A couple of years? A
couple of years, maybe 3-4. And pretty intensely. And we were doing sessions with 40-minute Zazen periods. So if you've never done that and you do that for the first time, it's pretty excruciating. But somehow, it really hooked me. You probably know this. When you do a session, even if you don't know what you're doing, just the focus and pushing through the pain, even if you tell yourself in the middle of it, I'm never going to do this again, there is some lightness on the other end. So the next few days after these sessions, I would just feel more clean and more clear and more light and more energetic. And without having to think about it, that just made me want to do it again and find out more.
So you're starting to get a little bit of experiential feedback, yeah, that this path is worth the effort.
Yeah. And just really from my own experience, I don't know any other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, some people have faith, you know, and that brings them, you know, some people probably more like me and you, we need kind of some sort of feedback that shows that it's, you know, worth the effort. You know, and plus, you know, I kind of blundered into psychedelics. And so that kind of gave me a little taste that reality is real. And so that always helped me to kind of have faith from the beginning. Were psychedelics part of your early life at all? Was that a thing in Germany? No.
I think I smoked one thing of pot and it didn't really do much. Wasn't interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you graduated university, you wanted to find a teacher. Were you able to find a teacher right away, or what were your next steps there?
I was pretty lucky. So I went to one of the international Zen centers that doesn't exist. It was led by a Noritake priest, but it's not the Noritake, the older one. That's a Dharma brother of my teacher, actually, who I think came to Rinzaiji for a while. And that place was Fukuyama, Fukuoka, somewhere between Okayama and Hiroshima in the mountains. Very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I went first, but it became pretty clear pretty soon that that was more like a Zen summer camp. And I wasn't going to go for that.
How did you know it existed to even go there?
I think I was told about it. I also did a lot of research in, there was a Zen guide that had a lot of places listed in it. And so I did a lot of research before I went.
So you pretty much were set on going to Japan to find a teacher as opposed to finding one in Europe.
Oh yeah. And there's one thing I did when I was still at university. At that time, nothing was in Romaji in Japan. So there was a trip offered from one department of going to Japan and looking at the architecture there. And so I went with that group, which then allowed me to know that even though I didn't speak the language at all, I could get around. Mm-hmm. And so then when I finished university and, you know, I figured before making major life decisions like having kids or starting a family or a 24-hour job as an architect, because in Germany, that's how it used to be. You're either totally in and overworked all the time or you are a better secretary. And so before making any of those decisions that could potentially be irreversible, I wanted to know, is there a real Zen master somewhere? And I knew there were second generation teachers in the States that I could more easily communicate with, but I felt, why not go to the source?
Mm-hmm. Was this in the 80s?
Oh boy. So I have to calculate. I'm 65, was born 65. So that would have been in the 80s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so that was my first trip with university. And then coming back to this place, I knew I don't need a summer camp.
When you say it was like a summer camp, could you articulate what you mean by that a little bit? Was it it wasn't intense or?
Intense enough. I mean, they did a Zazen schedule. They did chanting. They did Samu. There was no Sanzen. So basically things that I had done already.
Mm-hmm. Was it Rinzai or Soto?
Rinzai, yeah. So it was within this nice Japanese setting, but I knew that wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for more in-depth teaching and practice. And so I didn't even wait until the priest who had gone out for a couple of days came back to write me some recommendation. I just went over to Sogenji and showed up.
You went straight to Sogenji, yeah.
It just showed up.
So you had a couple of years of Zen practice under your belt at this point. What type of practice were you doing? Were you just doing counting your breaths or following your breaths?
We were doing already some version of Suzokan. So counting the breath and working with extending it and trying to develop the tongue and getting, you know, the energy in the lower body flowing and allowing the upper body to become more open and relaxed. So I think that was helpful.
Would you have, in those early years, would you actually have like tactile somatic sensations of chi energy, or is it more metaphorical for you?
No, I think I did. Mm-hmm. I did. And that saved me at Sogenji because maybe I was lucky that the Roshi at the time didn't speak English. So the communication had to be on a different level in part, at least.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Sogenji, was it still Mumon Yamada being the teacher, or was Harada Roshi already the teacher at that point?
No, Harada Roshi was the teacher. So I got there in 1990, I think. Mm-hmm. He'd been there for a couple of years with some senior students. Chisan was there. There was one American blind nun. And it was very funny because they didn't know what to do with me. I came unannounced, right? Mm-hmm. So I had all my stuff with me. And so I was ready to do the traditional thing of being thrown out. But that did not happen in that way. But because Chisan was not there as a translator, who usually helps Roshi to figure these things out and figure people out, he was pretty lost. So first he said, we can't kick you out now, so you can stay overnight, but tomorrow you have to leave. And then we had tea. And he asked me, do you have all your stuff with you? And so my alarms went on, uh-huh. And I said, yes, of course, I have all my stuff with me. And I really want to stay here. And there were some Japanese monks there at the time and one nun. And so he said, okay, if the nun is willing to take you on, you can stay during the time until Chisan comes back. In between, he had asked the blind nun to translate, and there was another encounter which really stays in my system. So I'm facing this other nun, and she's translating. And among what she's translating, he talks about, you know, sitting 12 hours a day. And I could just feel him trying to penetrate me for any reaction. And that was really funny. And he had great fun because I had already short hair. He'd never seen a woman with, you know, hair like an inch or so. It's like very funny for a Japanese guy of his generation. So he's like really astonished. And like, this looks like a nun whose hair has been growing out. And he laughed his deep laugh. And it was quite an experience.
Were you, you were there, you must have heard some reputation of Sogenji having serious practice before you went there. So I imagine you went there with some expectations. So what were your initial take on Roshi? Were you impressed with him? Were you underwhelmed? You know, what was your impression of him in general?
I think I think it was scary in the sense that I felt, and that most people experience it, you felt seen through, like nothing to hide. You felt naked in his presence.
Yeah. Did a lot of people talk about it, that he just seems very solid and
right.
kind of like very like, I always like the adjective for this, but just very like there, you know, did you get that impression with him too? Yeah.
So in the olden days, the key was all there. I mean, all there and going out. And it was very, very intense. And for some people, very intimidating. And it was very inspiring to see somebody being that much in their body and that present and that, in a sense, fearless, I would say. Mm-hmm. So I was very much inspired by that. But now also in retrospect, I would say, watching my own body and also seeing him age, the energy changes. Right. So there is a point about not being attached to a particular form of that energy, even though it was really impressive. And I worked with Earth. I was young. I was 24, 25. So I picked up a lot from his body and from his energy more than from what he was saying.
So you were given a day to stay there. Mm-hmm. So the next day, did just no one ask you to leave, or was it made explicit you could stick around, or how did that work?
Then one more tea happened, and then the nun agreed that she would take care of me, which meant getting up even earlier and opening the Honda with her because she was Denzel. And I think we did that for 1 or 2 days. Then she went to the States. And after he came back, I think I was interviewed by Chi-san. Mm-hmm. And I was never told I could stay, but I stayed.
Yeah. So at that point, she'd already been, because Chi-san started with Yamada Mumon, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she at that point was probably already a pretty senior practitioner, I imagine.
Yeah. And she was translating for the Roshi. Mm-hmm. So she was part his student and part his Dharma sister.
Yeah. So would she translate in Doku-san? Or did you guys call it Doku-san there? What was it?
Sanzen.
Would she translate in Sanzen?
Yeah, and that changed over the years. So you had to have translation during Sosan. Mm-hmm. So that's 3 times during a 7-day session where everybody goes formally in order and everybody has to go. And then when there wasn't Sosan, you could go without her. And Sanzens could be very, very short. But you had to have some translation at those Sosan times so the Roshi could actually communicate verbally also if he felt there was something that needed to be said. And of course, that changed once you are working with koans beyond a certain point. You need a little bit more language. So until I learned more Japanese, I had a phase where I went to with translation every time. And then at some point, I knew enough Japanese.
What were the early Sanzens? Were they mostly him giving you instructions on breath work?
Yeah, so we did the Susokan, and he would often just do it, right? I mean, for lack of words, possibly, but also it really worked for me where he just embodied it. He just did a breath. And mm-hmm. retrospect, I would say he would also have a sense of where my focus and my energy were. So as you know from practice, there are times when you bring in, where you focus everything and you need to really focus more and more narrower because otherwise you get distracted. There are times when you're very, very focused, almost over-focused, and you can get too narrow and can fizzle out. So then you need to open up more in an energetic way, kind of the peripheral view kind of sense. And so I think in retrospect, that's what he was expressing at some of the times in Sanzen, where he would just go and do a breath like this. And then he would do a breath like that. Sometimes he would say the whole universe, very impressive with him having these big sleeves and opening his arms wide. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of energy and a lot of just showing. He was just doing it. He was just being it. Mm-hmm. Time a little bit different. And so I think over time, it helped get a sense of, and again, not a rational sense at all. I can only speak about it later. How to work, right? When to work more intently on a rather narrow focus, when to open up more.
Were you given any... So I imagine it was just all technique. There's no discussion of samadhi or awakening or Four Noble Truths or... I mean, there was. I imagine there's no Buddhism 101 as part of the training there, right?
I mean, there were, of course, teishos, mm-hmm. which we all loved, even though we were at that time sitting in the Kohoju in excruciating pain, sitting through the whole teisho in zazen, right? But just his presence while he was talking, his energy would be very helpful. And then the snippets that we could understand, sometimes then you start to understand snippets in Japanese, right? And you pick up on the energy and then you get the translation. So there were some things where slowly over time a picture would fill in a little bit, and then you would get more pieces where you go, oh, I don't understand that. But curiously, and I tell that to people nowadays, don't think about it. Don't worry about not understanding something. When you need it, your system absorbs things. When you need it, you will remember. Mm-hmm. You don't need to try to remember with your head. So then suddenly in sitting, something would come up and I like, oh, that's what he's talking about. You know, and then I would know, okay, this, I'm probably on the right track.
When you know, presumably at some point you were switched over to Mu. Did you feel it coming, or was it kind of a surprise when he asked you to start doing Mu?
I think there was a sense, but it was also my way there was a little unusual in that I extended my visa once. So I was there for half a year, and then I went back for 3 months. And I was told later they did not expect me to come back, because most people that go, you know, I was living with my boyfriend and I could not just leave my stuff there with, you know, not even packing up. So I went packed up my stuff, put it in the attic, and worked for 3 months. And I did come back. So, and I think when I came back, he pretty soon put me on Mu, which was very early, but probably had to do with the fact that I had some practice before.
Mm-hmm. And how did he give you the instructions for Mu?
As far as I can recall, he basically said, do the same as with the breath. So I would go in and show a breath, and people do it just with a air sound. Some people would do it with voice. I like doing it with voice because you feel the resonance in your body more. That gives you kind of a better feedback loop, in a sense, a better sensations in the body. And he basically said, do the same thing, just replace the number with the move. And then as we went on, he would sometimes give a little bit of instructions. And you would hear them also in Teisho.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your experience working with Mu? You know, how did that change your practice? Or did it?
Well, it was pretty smooth in a sense, but also very challenging because at that time, I really wanted to know what is enlightenment, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't like I knew what it is. Everybody has their ideas, but I was just unbelievably curious. What is this big deal about? What is this about? What is a breakthrough about? What is it like? And so I really went for it. I was the right age. I had a lot of energy. I got up earlier than 3:30 even at times and sat behind the hondo in the hills. And I was just going for it. And so there were ups and downs, but at some point, I think I got a physical sense of what now in retrospect, I would call samadhi. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was just, there was just a sense. There was a sense of somehow a pretty straight line through it all, even though if you look at it from the outside, you try this, you try that. From the inner experience, it felt pretty straightforward. Things would fall into place. You would try something and then you would see, okay, that's not it. And see that as a confirmation of where to go rather than looking back and punishing yourself, thinking, oh my God, I've done it wrong. I wasted so much time, right? When we see when this wisdom, which is the sword of wisdom, seeing through where and what to let go, when that becomes activated, we can very easily use that for self-loathing. Oh, I've wasted so much time. Oh, it's been wrong all the time. No, it's not. It's now I know, right? Now I know not this. So it gets narrower. It becomes more clear. I can let that go too. Mm-hmm. And I found that very helpful.
So when you finally broke open, did you feel it coming or did it take you completely by surprise?
There was a sense of, like my teacher likes to say, the cup starting to be filled to the brim at some point, and it would be just a matter of time if I just kept going. Mm-hmm. Something would happen at some point and have to happen at some point.
Was there any reluctance on your part of you know, part of you not wanting to let go that was kind of holding back, or were you just willing to jump off the cliff?
Well, I thought I wanted to jump off, but, you know, ego can't do that, right? That's the tricky part. No matter how much you want it, how much you think you want it, it's just not working on that level. You can't take yourself with you there because it's not that kind of thing. It's not a me going from A to B, mm-hmm. right? It's totally different. It's this whole matrix falling away. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be, you know, what you could call this moment of grace, this moment of surrender. And so there's the struggle. But I had a sense that if I just hung out there, if I just stuck with it, if I just stuck with it and would persevere at this point where it really felt like there's no more going forward. I don't know where to go, but I can't go back. Some sense of being on this edge of a precipice, but not being able to jump, right? You're even willing to jump, but you can't. Mm-hmm. It has to come in a sense from the other side. And mm-hmm. so all I could do is just hang there. And it was pretty intense at times.
It makes me think of the koan, the guy hanging by his teeth from the branch.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, the Mumonkan commentary is bafflingly precise, where he says it's like you have swallowed this iron ball and you can't spit it out and you can't swallow it. I actually felt like mm-hmm. you know, there's something stuck there and I just you want to do something but you can't, because you can't, ego can't do it. Mm-hmm. So you try that but you just hang in there.
So when things dropped away and you went to Sanzen, do you think Roshi could sense it immediately?
Yeah, I think we both knew. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. It also showed in my breath. I mean, the lack of self-conscious awareness and also how surprisingly long the breath came out, or in this case, then the mu came out. It was just different. I mean, I think we both knew. Mm-hmm. Something had shifted. Which, you know, in later koans doesn't necessarily mean the teacher will let you go, but he then started to put me on subsequent koans. But before that, you had to go through the checking questions. Mm-hmm. So with me at least, and I think he did that at the time with most people, he did a lot of checking questions, which I think help to make sure that you know you have a sense of where to go, that you're not falling into nihilism too much, that you're also not falling into grasping at stuff too much, that you can actually kind of navigate there right on the edge of it. Mm-hmm. And then you're asked for the source of Mu, and it took Roshi a while to convince me because I had so much fun expressing, right? Convinced me that I couldn't manifest it, but eventually it dropped. So,
yes, source of Mu was my, I don't know, favorite is the right word, was the most meaningful koan I've ever been through.
Yeah.
That was like a huge inflection point for me. So when you got into the koan curriculum, how would he introduce a new koan to you? Would he just say the name, or would he recite the entire koan? Like, would he give you a piece of paper? Like, how, I know I'm kind of geeking out on this a little bit, but I always get really interested on the mechanics of this stuff.
It changed over time. So I still have these handwritten in kanji and then in romanji underneath, handwritten notes by him, mm-hmm. where he would actually give you the koan, do his nice calligraphy-like writing, and write the romanji under it. And you would just recite the romanji when you would come in. Mm-hmm. But there were always times when he passed you on a koan and didn't have anything ready. So then he would try to communicate which one would be the next. You would go to Chisan, try to figure out what was going on. Sometimes she was too busy and you got desperate because you didn't know what to do in your next sanzen. But then he would give you the paper, or, you know, somehow it would resolve itself and you would finally figure out where you were. But a lot of times he would give you a new piece of paper. Nowadays, he has it all in his computer, which makes his life much easier, so he can just print it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you at that point, were you guys doing capping phrase work?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it was the olden days before the Zen Sand. And so we had books that were, I think, Yuho, Tom Kirshner, wrote the kanji by hand, and there were, it looked like typewriters written romanji in both English and Japanese, and we worked with those books. And at the beginning it was very thrilling and scary, but I was not good at that. It took me a long time sometimes. The first ones, I felt a lot in my body. So reading through this book diagonally, your body would recognize the right one. But then going further down into the koan curriculum, I felt I had a really hard time sometimes. And I think that was a very beneficial challenge, because you had to both kind of keep the focus of the koan, but you had simultaneously had to open your mind wide so you wouldn't miss a phrase that would pertain to the koan coming from a completely different angle. Mm-hmm. And you trying to figure that out in your head wouldn't work. So it felt often like holding the overall sense of it somewhere in your system, but it couldn't be too intellectual. And yet there was something you had to hold from the initial experience and then find the resonance.
Mm-hmm. The koan system I'm working on is, you know, through Harada Yasutani's system. I assume you're familiar.
A little bit.
Yeah. And so we don't do, capping phrases. I'm curious it's a little bit of a mystery to me. I mean, what do you think the utility of the capping phrase is? Do you think it's just deepening the wisdom of the koan deeper, or do you think it's just confirming your actual comprehension of it? What purpose is the capping phrase?
I think it's both of those, and maybe even more. I think on a very fundamental level, it forces you to cultivate the place from where the answers come from, mm-hmm. right? From where ideally we function in our everyday life. And so this extra challenge provides an extra, how to put it? I think it forces you to dig deeper and open up that place much more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really about that. And the koans are tools. And then there's, of course, there's deep meaning in when you are actually working with it and experience it, right? But looking at it from the outside, it's totally meaningless. So for me, cultivating the place from where we want to live, from where the wisdom comes from, right? The place that you can't really describe in words. Some people say not knowing, well, which is words again. It's more of a profound curiosity that resonates somewhere, ideally, if you found your tandem, somewhere in your lower belly. A little bit like if you try to write poetry or read poetry or anything else that touches you in that fundamental sense, right? That there is a resonance. If you try to write a poem, you don't know the words, but there's a sense. So this being able to dig into this activity of not knowing, this curiosity that is there. I mean, I think that's what's the most important here, to cultivate and to activate and to learn to trust more and more. Mm-hmm.
So for Mu, you know, passing Mu was, you know, a clearly distinct event. You know, there needed to be a dropping away. So for subsequent koans, like how would you know that you had the correct presentation just intuitively, or were you in doubt all the way up to the sanzen? Like was there an aha moment? Did you have like an inspiration, you know, or did it depend on the koan? Like,
it depends on the koan. And since you mentioned lineages, right, we are doing the inzan, we're not going through the books, but the Zen Saint Victor Sogen Hori describes it very nicely, how they are generally grouped. Mm-hmm. And I think the grouping has a little bit to do with what the experience is like, right? If you're working on the Dharma body koans, well, they all more or less pull the rug out from under you, mm-hmm. right? Different ways. If you're working on the koans of manifestations, that's again, there's a little bit of a different flavor. But generally, through it all, the Rishi is looking at least as much for a shift as for an answer. I'm told that of the Dharma heirs of Mumon Roshi, he was the most meticulous one. He's a Virgo, right? Mm-hmm. So he likes if you get close enough to the right answer. But sometimes you would find the right answer in the first danzen, and he would just bring you out.
Because the shift wasn't there.
Yeah, because it was too flat. I mean, kind of flat. You didn't have to put this work on. You didn't dig into that place of where you really don't know. You didn't lose everything on the way, right? So then on the other side, there is also not this renewed sense of openness and nakedness and rawness and freedom. Mm-hmm. So we are very lucky that he would not let us get away with anything mm-hmm. half-baked.
Not including the checking questions, do you know how many koans are there in his koan curriculum?
Oh boy, I have not counted. And I know that he keeps even chisan on koans. Mm-hmm. So there is a basic curriculum, but I think it depends on how you count. So mm-hmm. there are some people that count the checking questions as koans, mm-hmm. and then there are people who count the different parts in the koan that are officially there, like when Joshua answers one time mu and one time yes, right? Those are considered different ones. Some people would consider the whole mu koan, the one case, one koan. So I haven't gone there. I don't know.
So I'd like to ask you a little bit about what it's like living there. Could you walk through people what a typical schedule would be like at Sogenji on a non-sashin day?
Well,
like give people a flavor of what it would be like to live at Sogenji.
There are about 3 to 5 non-sashin days.
Okay. Nice.
And those are different now. So I'm told because the Rishi is traveling so much, there are no free days, non-session days, unless he is traveling. Mm-hmm. So, but we used to have a so-called free day the day after a session, unless, again, there was an event or a ceremony or something. And that meant sleeping until six and then going out to do sweeping until breakfast and then having off until the evening bell and dinner, unless you had a job. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were in charge of greeting the guests, you didn't get time off. If there were two fuzui, then you would kind of switch off. But sometimes there would be big events and then both of you were needed. You didn't get any free time. Then there is a couple of days sometimes, but used to be between the sessions where we had the usual schedule, getting up at 3:30, doing choka, doing sanzen, doing breakfast, doing niten soji, inside and outside cleaning. And then everybody has to be there for lunch. Some was until lunch and lunch, the time changed. Nowadays, the afternoons are free. We had days, times when we had maybe 30 minutes after lunch. And then we would go back to Samu. Then in the olden days, I think dinner was formal. Then later it was changed to being informal, so you don't have to go. And then they're sitting from a non-session days, 6:30 till 8:30, and then kaichin at 9, and then you would go to Yaza. Mm-hmm. So the absolute minimum of sitting would still be like 4 to 5 hours.
Mm-hmm. What? How did Yaza work? Was there a degree of competitiveness among the people, or would people just go off privately and do Yaza? Like, what was the culture for that there?
In the very old days, you could sit almost everywhere where you wanted. Mm-hmm. And
sorry to interrupt, but so for people who don't know, Yaza is kind of optional night sitting after the formal practice ends. So that's what we're talking about.
In the olden days, it was really nice. The Rishi, the group was a little smaller, and the Rishi took the time to do kentan, so his Yaza check, and visit you. So people had their spots where they would sit Yaza. I would sit in this ancient daimyo graveyard behind the hondo, which, you know, you had a very nice space and you could feel the energy of the graves and the hondo, and you had this wide expanse of scenery in front of you. And I really loved that. And he would come by and do his Yaza check there. And then later on nowadays, everybody has to sit under the eaves of the buildings. And I think Rohatsu is an exception. During Rohatsu, people can sit inside the zendo also. And then he does his kentan, his Yaza check. He carries an incense, high quality incense. So after he passes by, that remains in the air and you can hear his very even, centered, grounded walk. And it's a really nice atmosphere under the stars, sometimes when it's chilly, no matter what the weather. Mm-hmm. It's quite an experience, and especially in this traditional surrounding.
Yeah. You know, when I've sat up at Daishu and West, I've never was given instructions on Yaza, but it always seemed just obvious, like you don't leave until the more senior monks leave. Is that similar?
Etsu Genji, it wasn't that. It was more like some people would leave right after where she came for kentan. And then obviously if you're looking up at capping phrases, you would try to get out to Yaza as late as possible and look up capping phrases somewhere in the toilet as long as possible. And then after he passed by, you would go right back there. So it's kind of depends on the person. Some people sit even in chairs. You know, sometimes somebody gets injured or it gets too much. So I've seen people do Yaza on a chair. And the Roshi is essentially fine with that. And some people will sit all night. And for some people, that works. know, depending on where they are in their practice. And then there are some people who are get attached to the form of it. Yes, I've had set through the whole night, but then I sleep the whole time during Zazen and pull the whole Zendo down. You know, there's something to be said about right effort.
How are the interpersonal relationships among the sitters there? Like in my short monastic experience, you know, a big part of it was, you know, it's kind of like living with the people you work with, you know, you'd never get a break from them. So there was, even though there wasn't a lot of like outright hostility, there's a lot of like tension, interpersonal tensions, you know, that I think in retrospect was kind of part of the practice. Was that your experience at all there, or how did that play out for you?
It's a pressure cooker on all levels. And at the worst times, I later on found myself pulling new people away, saying, you know, in a way, the fact if somebody acts out, that's not a good thing, but it also in a way shows that the practice is working, because we are in this pressure cooker. And the schedule pushes you, the worship pushes you or rejects you, comes down to the same tension, right? Your own stuff comes up because you are more raw, you are more an edge. And so when your stuff comes up, then you can see it, sometimes to the point where you can't avoid it anymore. It's right in your face for you to see, and sometimes, unfortunately, also for everybody else to see. Mm-hmm. But then you really get to work on it, and some your surrounding will reflect it back to you. And so there is something to be said about that way of working. But again, I think there were times where I was a little bit too dysfunctional and where something could have been said. Mm-hmm. And that's just not what happens in traditional monasteries. I think Sogenji now, with Roshi and Tisan having that much more experience and more experience with Westerners, it's every time I went back, it's been much better aligned and much more harmonious and not anywhere less intense. But I think in the olden days, they just did the Japanese thing where these things are never being addressed. And sometimes Westerners need to hear things directly, and some of the psychological stuff needs to be dealt with. And so
would you ever see people who would come and they're just not psychologically ready for that kind of practice, and they have to be asked to leave? Or
well, most of the time it resolved itself, something would happen, and then either they would realize that it wasn't for them, or they had to be asked to leave. But I mean, we had psychotic people there, mm-hmm. you know, and I could tell they were psychotic, you know, somebody walking like this. And they were not asked to leave until something happens. And, you know, I think we don't want to over psychoanalyze. Air, you can absorb them. Something that's not completely wrong. But if there are this obvious problems, then I think it's wiser to and kinder to send the person off and get them some help, mm-hmm. in the interest of their own practice, because, you know, sometimes people hit a roadblock, and if they get the right help and the right tools, they can get through it pretty quickly. Or they can suffer for years or and years and even decades and harm themselves and others, worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm. Kind of on that topic, do you think there's a difference between spiritual growth and psychological healing? Do you think they go hand in hand? Do you think they're different phenomenon? And what do you think the relationship is?
I think there is, of course, we release some of our psychological stuff with the practice, just by sorting through our conditioning and not giving into our habitual thoughts, right? But I think there is also room to do separate psychological work, and psychological insights are not awakening, and states of mind are not awakening. and having an experience of oneness is not awakening. So it's clearly on a different level. But I think once you've reached a certain point, even though all of your stuff isn't mysteriously going away, there is more of a willingness to work with it, mm-hmm. and a little bit more of an understanding how, and ideally also the humility. I'm not perfect, right? And even having had even if it was a deep experience, there's still going to be habit energies floating around, and you're still going to fall into your own old habits sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's why the advanced practice is so important. Mm-hmm. And to continue, not get stuck anywhere on the path. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think you love Tore too. Tore is such a great teacher, mm-hmm. because that's one book, The Inexhaustible Lamba of Tore Zenji, is the one book that really, really clearly points that out.
Yeah, it's pretty much the best Zen book in existence, I think. Yeah. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the difference between oneness and awakening and how you contrast them?
Well, oneness is basically different types of samadhi, I would say. And you can analyze them. You can look at them through the lens of Theravada, the jhanas. But the energy that comes with these states can be very freeing, very blissful, can be all kinds of things. And you want to stay halfway up the mountain and enjoy the scenery. And I think that's the point where a teacher is really necessary to point out that you can't settle down in some other comfort zone, no matter how advanced you think it may be. And it's really this falling away of that oneness, where then the real oneness in a way can function through you. But mm-hmm. there is no more an ego experiencing it, right? It's not my experience. It's a totally different sense.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to transition a little bit from your practice at Soganji to eventually you go back to Europe and you help set up some sanghas. How long did you practice at Soganji before you were asked to kind of step into that role?
I think about 15 years. And then somebody had a sponsor to finance me coming to Hungary for a year. Mm-hmm. I think I'd been there with the Roshi for a session, and somehow they really wanted me there. And so they found somebody who was willing to finance my stay for a year. And they asked the Roshi, and the Roshi came to me and said, well, I think this would be a good thing where you are in your practices would be a good thing to do. And so I stayed there for a year full time. And then I did 3 months, because I felt I needed to go back to Soganji. So I did 3 months in Hungary, 3 months in Japan, going back and forth. And I think in retrospect, that was a very fruitful time, a very healthy time.
It maybe helped ground you a little bit in reality.
It helped clarify things. It also brought up new questions that I then got a chance to explore. Mm-hmm. And the Sangha is still alive there and well and pretty established and pretty big. So I think it was a win-win for everybody.
Do you still go back and visit them?
I wish I would have time. Mm-hmm. I would love to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I travel already too much, so...
Mm-hmm. So was it hard for you after 15 years of nearly daily sanzen? Was it hard to not have that? I imagine that opened up new vistas of practice, not having to report basically every day, you know, and have that kind of your battery refilled with that experience.
Well, that wasn't really the issue for me so much. It was more, how do I keep this going and how do I make it work for people here? Mm-hmm. That was the scary part that I didn't have any experience with, right? Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, I went back to some of the Roshi's writing, which of course was also an opportunity to check my own practice. Mm-hmm. I read this little booklet Now it's called How to Do Zazen, was called What is Zazen at the time, over and over and over again. And I discovered new things for myself there while I was trying to find a way to share it, right? So it's kind of the first baby steps. Having the experience doesn't make you a teacher. Having the experience doesn't enable you to present it and make it click for people, make it work for people, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful for that time. And towards the end of that time, I think I invited Jeff Shore to come. Mm-hmm. It's also a very good experience for me because I decided to practice with him for a while, and he actually asked me to lead some of his retreats. And so I got a little bit of a different view of somebody who teaches in English. Mm-hmm. And I found that very beneficial to kind of widen my horizon a little bit, experience a little bit of a different flavor, see how I respond and how other people respond.
Mm-hmm. What a little bit of a tangent. Speaking of Jeff Shore, what do you think of his contention that in the West, a lot of what is authenticated in Sanzen is is Kensho awakening isn't really awakening, and we're kind of all fooling ourselves out here. Do you think there's any truth to it? Or
probably true. I mean, yeah. I hear stories that transmitted Zen teachers describe a state of oneness as awakening. Mm-hmm. And well, it's not awakening. And yeah, so I mean, I can't really judge us. I don't know the people well enough. So I would like to err on the side of humility. But my teacher also seems to think that there are issues. And I think the scandals that are still going on with second generation teachers of the first generation of abusers kind of show that there is a lack of practice and a lack of integration of practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we may have talked about this separately. I think part of the problem in the West is a lot of the early generation of teachers kind of became teachers with either incomplete or sometimes almost non-existent training. I think in Japan, a lot of times you're practicing a good 30 years before it's even a question of teaching. Yeah. Whereas a lot of teachers in America, they're basically teaching after, 3 or 4 years.
Or even 10 years is too early.
Yeah.
Because you're a baby, you don't know what you're doing. I mean, you have some experience, but that doesn't mean that you can share it. Mm-hmm. And my teacher made a very good point when he was here. What he's been doing with all of his students, he keeps us coming back to do Sanzen with him. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out that he feels that it's extremely beneficial to both, while already teaching, put oneself under and be a student again. And I wholeheartedly agree. I think I know a couple of people that are doing it or have been. The slightly scared thrill of, not knowing what's going to happen. And you remember very viscerally how you felt in your own training. Mm-hmm. And you don't become this person who is on top of it all and knows it all. And it keeps you on your toes and it keeps the practice pure, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right now you're officially the assistant teacher at Hidden Valley Zen Center. How did you meet Mita Roshi? She is in Kaplow's lineage, is that correct?
She's transmitted by Kaplow, and she went to Sogenji. I think they do something like they do a pilgrimage after they finish their official Koan curriculum, which seems to be more publicly announced over there. Mm-hmm. They go on a pilgrimage, and she decided to go to Japan mostly, and she came by Sogenji. And she loved it. And so she came back, and she actually was there, I don't remember how long, but at least for a year, part of the time we shared a room. Mm-hmm. And she kept coming back once or twice a year for several years. And so we got to know each other. And when I was ordained in 1995, I believe, it was very sweet. She wanted to stay for my ordination. And Kaplo Roshi called her back, says, I want to give you transmission. And he kept calling her back. And she wrote him a letter saying, you know, I really want to stay for this person's ordination. And she showed me the letter that he wrote back saying, look how let go he is. Like, she knew he really wanted her to come back, but he was also very understanding and kind, saying, I understand that there is an important karmic connection, and so come back afterwards.
Mm-hmm. How did you... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, no.
Oh, and how did you, so you guys were friends, obviously, connected. How did it come about for you to come to the States and be assistant teacher there?
Yeah, so I had been, after Hungary, I was in Munich, which is where I grew up. And I tried to establish a Zen group there, which still functions. But it was very hard to find a bigger space where you could actually settle down and do some semblance of monastic practice. Mm-hmm. Prices are extremely high, and it's not like you go a little bit outside the city and then the prices drop. Anywhere where you can get within 2 hours by public transportation or car is impossible, unless somebody gives you something for free. And so I think Mitra Roshi had knee surgery, wanted to go to the session at Tahoma, ended up staying at her sister's house, who lived on Whidbey Island at the time. And the Roshi realized that she wasn't in good shape. She is now, but at the time. And so I don't know exactly how the communication between the two of them happened, but I was eventually asked if I would go and be in the States with Mitra Roshi, and maybe, I think the idea was, take over one of her places. And I think my teacher at the time didn't know about Hidden Valley Zen Center. I stayed with her a little bit at Mountain Gate, and then she took me a couple of times to come down here. And we, at some point, she felt that this would be the place for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think then I was here for 3 months. They got me the R visa and eventually got me over for good. Mm-hmm. So
do you have a green card?
Right now I have a green card. I'm going to have to go for citizenship, but I need to make sure I don't lose my German citizenship, because there is healthcare there and all of that stuff. So, and my mother is still living there. So, mm-hmm. I should get that started rather soon, but.
Mm-hmm. So this is a little bit of a touchy subject, but my understanding is you're kind of in the final stages of preparation for Inka Shimone with Harada. Is that something you feel comfortable talking about? Or I know this is always
since weird. You asked, I can't say no.
Yeah. And at that point, do you think you'll continue working with him? Because I know he does Zoom Sansen now, right? Which I would have thought he's the last person in the world to do it. I'm really impressed that he's doing that. But do you see yourself still working with him as long as you can?
I do that in person, so I haven't done it on Zoom so far. Yeah, right. I don't know if I ever will. Mm-hmm. I think that medium, how to put it, I think at this point it may be kind to leave him to the people who really, really, really need him to be there, mm-hmm. you know? And I go do Sanzen when he's coming to Tahoma, or if I ever make it back to Japan, I hope I will, mm-hmm. When I do go to Japan.
So speaking of Zoom, it sounds in. So do you work with students over Zoom? Like, how do you feel about the medium of it?
It depends. I think if I know the person, it can work. If I don't know the person at all, I'm a little bit more cautious. I think it's possible. You know, it's not ideal, but I think I was very critical of it at first, but I think you can sense more than I originally expected. Let's put it that way.
So I imagine, so the students there, the Sangha, I imagine they're, some of them are very kind of long-term Mitra Roshi students. Is that correct?
Yes, there are a couple still around. Yes.
So I imagine they're pretty deep into the Kapalo Kwan curriculum, but now they're working with you. Like, how do you deal with that? Or do they just work with Mitra? Like, how do you guys navigate that?
Right now, the people that are here that are still there, they are still on their first koan. It's just not a problem.
I see.
And it has never come up like that. But I think if that were the case, then they would have to decide with whom they want to work, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever work on koans with Mitra to compare and contrast the different? Or do you guys talk about it informally? No.
Yeah, we talked a little bit, but we didn't do formal sans, and that would not have felt appropriate at that time.
So having talked to her about having been in the Harada, I'm in the Harada Yasutani lineage, and I'm always curious because you don't really talk about what happens in Sanzen as far as like answers and go. So it's a degree of opacity for me. Like, do you think the type of answers we're coming up with in Harada Yasutani, are they kind of the equivalent of Rinzai, or are they just a totally different beast? Do you have any sense of that?
I have no idea because I've not talked with people from your lineage about it.
Oh, I thought maybe you talked about Mitra about it.
No, not about answers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, of course, she's trained with my teacher, so that may make a difference. But I feel there is definitely some affinity. Mm-hmm. I can't tell how much that has to do with the lineage or with her as a person. But for her, it seemed like it was a very very natural transition. And she seems to have a very good relationship with my teacher. And they found a way of working together very effectively. So I think that may speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. So I want to be respectful of your time, but there's one more thing I'd like to hit on with you. And so you come from a tradition of deep, deep monastic training. In the United States, you know, monastic training is the minority situation. You know, most people are householders, living their lives, you know, maybe visiting their local Zen center once a week, maybe twice a week, maybe every couple months doing a 7-day session or something. Do you think that, I'll just say it bluntly. Do you think that's enough practice? Do you think the monastic practice is a necessity, or do you think there's a path forward for more lay style practice where you're still a householder and, you don't have responsibilities of family and work and so forth? What's your opinion of that?
I think it's not either or. It's, mm-hmm. It depends on the underlying commitment. Mm-hmm. And in my own practice, I often hit points where I felt, oh, wow, I've still been looking outside. In other words, I still wasn't as committed just because I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a matter of what's your focus in life? How strong is your doubt? Maybe how much are you focused, no matter what you do, on the practice? Is that the underlying principle, or is it an addition like a hobby that you do when you have some free time? That's really the point. And then it's up to us to find ways nurture that in the best possible way. And I think there can be as many ways as there are people. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, that said, as long as there's more than one-to-one involved, you want a framework. And I think there is great benefit to monastic practice, ideally in Japan, actually, because there's something in... I like the culture. And I found being in these ancient buildings and breathing the air there, so to speak, I think I felt some of the essence through that, right? But that's also, that may not be true for everybody. So I think I would say anybody I could send to Japan for a year, a couple of years, I would do that. Mm-hmm. Monastic practice here is a question mark. I mean, we provide it if anybody wants to do it that way, but it is certainly not the only way. The problem is we keep watering it down. But as I said, underlying it is what's the essence. You can have a monastery full of monks and perform all the monastic forms, and there can be a total lack of essence, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can find that even in Japan. There seems to be a lot of monastic experience in Japan that's really just people are there just to get their temple priest license, and then they
like I said, like a Zen summer camp. Mm-hmm. Not that that would be wrong, because for the right person, be what gets them really into the practice and into more sincere practice. Mm-hmm. But many person die can do that. Working in hospice can do that. Anything can do that. Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy subject. And I think it has to evolve. We have this idea historically, right? Zen coming to Japan in this way, and these people did it, if you read a history book. But what we don't see is the struggles, the going back and forth, how many people were involved in the process, right? And we also lack to see how even right now, any time of history, it's always been changing. Mm-hmm. And we are just in another moment, in another right here, right now, of that flow. And we have to find our way. And I think the most important thing is to really honestly keep asking that practice. What works best? And what works best with the people that are here now? And what works best for the Western mind? And then we will find our way. Mm-hmm. So I've weaned a little bit away from the very formal practice. I'm coming back, or very formal monastic style practice. Then in some aspects, I find myself coming back to it a little bit. And then I'm learning as I move along. And I've seen my teacher change things in the monastery. I've seen him change the schedule. I've seen him at times harshly re-implement some rules. Like there was one time where he went back to, you could not wear any long underwear that would go, any further than here. And in winter, you could not wear long underwear that was, could just go over the knee, but not any further. So you were really cold and the frostbites were really getting bad. Mm-hmm. And then there were times when he was much more relaxed, and it had to do with a much bigger picture than just some kind of form. Mm-hmm. And I think the form to fall back is something to fall back on when we don't know. And it should not be thrown out, because there is something in the system of, Teisho, Sanzen, Zazen, Samu, that works together to grind down the ego and to make us get out of our comfort zone, confront these our resistance, confront the ego that helps them break it down. But different people need different things at different times. And a lot of that can be, I think, responded to within a certain system. But then certain things, for example, the Keisaku, at some point right now, still we don't have the Keisaku because we had people that were hit with belts as children and were so traumatized that if you walk by with a stick, you know, their PTSD is triggered. Mm-hmm. And so
you see this happen.
Yeah. And so I don't think there is an easy answer and a right answer. I think it's very much case by case.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody was interested in working with you, is the best way to get in touch with you or visit Hidden Valley, is the best way to get in touch with you through the Hidden Valley website?
Yeah, email is fine. Okay. The phone number is somewhere on there. And depending on the situation, again, some people that work that are around here, I ask them to come to an interview. We do monthly half day introductions. I usually do them on Zoom also. Mm-hmm. And ideally, if they come in person, we see them, right? There's a lot, you know, you kind of have a sense this could be a fit or no way, right? When you meet somebody in person and when you see a place. Mm-hmm. And then we would ask people to come for sessions and then go from there.
Mm-hmm. This may sound like a weird question, but I'm curious. Do you guys do Rinzai style choka there, or do you follow the forms of the Kapalo?
We do my lineage. So I actually, since my teacher came to visit before that, since Mito Roshi stepped down, I slowly and hesitantly started to change the sutra books from a mixed version to our version, so people don't get confused that come from my lineage. Mm-hmm. And I managed to reuse the same paper because we made these nice hand-bound books that are double folded pages.
Okay.
So I could use the old sutra book folded over and print on the other side. And that made me feel like I'm not throwing something out, but I'm honoring it. Mm-hmm. It's still there. We are grateful for all the work that has been done by all the people that came before here. I mean, we are so lucky, 23 acres, a huge, beautiful zendo, mm-hmm. A sizable dining hall. I mean, we are really blessed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. I know I say this a lot, but I really want to get down and visit you guys when I can.
Anytime.
Yep. Great.
Yeah, where are you?
Near Sacramento. So maybe 6 or 7 hours. Not too bad.
Yeah. Or, you know, you can fly in. It's 40, 50 minutes from the airport if you don't pick rush hour.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate the time. This was an interview I was looking forward to do for months. Excited to finally do it. And really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And feel free to get in touch. Anybody who is interested in serious Rinzai Zen practice.
Okay.
I'm here to help.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.